sí, siempre, siempre, time, sí.
Yes,
sí.
Combine, Chaka and Billy sound fine. Combine, Lord. 010 Mr. 119. What's the 2 DJ them all them sound so fine. Everybody come a dance and I go down the line. Yes, and my Billy, you fine sound fine. Combine, them are you sound fine.
And welcome to Labor Radio, the August edition. It's August 18th. As always, you can catch us on the third Thursday of the month here on CKUT 90.3 FM from 5 to 6 p.m. you can also catch us on the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Look that up online. I'm your co-host, Stefan.
And this is Mustafa. And we have had a pretty great show for you this month.
Yeah, joined once again. Last time that he was with us was not even that long ago, less than a year ago. But Doug Nesbitt, editor at rankandfile.ca, we talked about Unifor, a lot of Unifor talk this month.
Yeah, and especially as the largest private sector union in Canada, 350,000 members, convention this past week, which saw a contested election on the heels of a pretty major corruption scandal at the top of the leadership.
So lots to talk about. Make sure you check out Doug's website, rankandfile.ca. It can help you dig deeper a bit. Some of the stories that they've done on this are really helpful to understanding the context. But so that's the show for this month. It's a really long interview, so bear with us. But hope you enjoy it, and thanks for listening.
Yeah, you're listening to Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
So, welcome back to Labor Radio here on CKUT. We're happy to be joined by Doug Nesbitt, the editor of rankandfile.ca. We're going to be having a big episode on Unifor. Obviously, they just had their convention, and also they've been in the news for other reasons as well, which is something that Rank and File has covered. So, really happy to have you again with us, Doug.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, I guess to get us started, do you want to talk about some of the work that Rank and File has done on Unifor in the last few weeks? I mean, it's kind of like a big question, maybe for those who haven't been made aware of what happened at Unifor, I guess over the last 6 months, or maybe it's been almost a year now, but what's happened at Unifor and what are the news that have kind of come to be so that you're again writing about them?
Yeah, so the past, well, really since February and March, there's been big changes in Unifor. Everyone knew that there was a convention coming this August that's just happened. And Jerry Diaz, the national president of Unifor, there was a lot of understanding that he wouldn't run again. But in February and March, the news got out that he was involved in a basically a corruption scandal within the union, and the union did an internal investigation and found that he had accepted a $50,000 kickback from a PPE supplier, and Diaz had brokered a deal between the PPE supplier and employers that had collective agreements with Unifor. And there was a big, huge explosion around that within Unifor, because Diaz has run for the last 9 years a really, really tight ship and a very dictatorial organization, where what the law is what he says it is within Unifor. And that has meant that the union has had successes, but it's also had these massive catastrophic errors and defeats. And this also disrupted his transition plan, which was one of his assistants, Scott Doherty, was selected, in fact, nominated, or he was nominated by Diaz as the successor to him as national president, and the National Executive Board of Unifor unanimously supported that motion. And this was in February, just as the investigation into Diaz's internal investigation into Diaz's improprieties had started. In fact, I should clarify that it wasn't an internal investigation. It was a third party investigation based on the Unifor's constitution. They brought in a law firm that conducted the investigation into what had happened and to see if Diaz had broken or breached the code of ethics for the union. And they did, in fact, find that. So by March, it was Diaz had retired. He was under investigation. The union, Unifor, eventually came out and said that he, in fact, had breached the code of ethics. And then that led to one of the other people on the National Executive Board, Lana Payne, to throw her hat in the ring for national president. And there was also another candidate who opposed Scott Doherty's coronation. His name, David Cassidy, if I remember correctly. He is the, did I get the name right?
Yeah.
He's the president of Unifor Local 444 down in Windsor, which is the kind of famous local representing a whole bunch of workers, but really based out of, I can't even remember what the name of the auto company is anymore. It keeps changing. Chrysler, FCA, Stellantis, whatever it's called now. So it was a three-way race, and basically that whole scandal blew up Doherty's coronation. And then that's all led into this convention where Lana Payne won. And I didn't really expect her to win. I thought Doherty would be able to pull it off, because it's a delegated convention. It isn't a one member, one vote. So there's a whole patronage system that often is involved in selecting who the delegates are that go to convention. And so the votes are already kind of determined beforehand. But clearly that wasn't the case. So we had this outburst of democracy for a brief moment that led to a little bit of an upsetting of the apple cart within Unifor. You know, there are limits to the degree to which you can say that this is like a radical democratic change in Unifor. I mean, Lana Payne has been a long-serving member of the Unifor National Executive Board. Some of her supporters have Gavin McGarrigle, who is the Western Regional Director. He's been on the NEB for a long time. So there are many usual suspects involved as well. But it does seem like something shook loose. But the union now has to deal with some pretty daunting problems that are ahead of them based on what's happened over the last 9 years with Diaz, from their exit from the Canadian Labour Congress, the disastrous raids they tried to conduct in Toronto with the hotel workers and the transit workers. And there's a lot of... based on the NEB minutes that were released, there's a lot of efforts, there's a lot of dissent within the membership, but there are even efforts to decertify that were reported in the national executive minutes. So there's clearly a lot of dissent at the base of the union. And it's a really huge union and a lot of really strategically important sectors of the economy, from, manufacturing, metal fabrication, mining, forestry, transit. It's a huge sector. Airlines, of course, huge sectors, important sectors. So it's I don't envy Lana Payne's task, but it remains to be seen if she can actually break the mold and kind of take Unifor in a more democratic direction. Can you actually create the space for there to be more democratic involvement of the membership? And also then there are big questions about what are the strategies going to be politically versus employers, and then in the kind of formal politics of parliament and provincial governments, because one of those legacies of Diaz is lobbying government for investment, lobbying government for basically corporate welfare. And we've seen that with how the electric car transition is going, which is just billions of dollars of public money being handed over to the auto manufacturers to do the transition and avoiding any kind of effort to do some kind of planned transition that might cut out some of these big car corporations and actually create more jobs and do the job quicker. And better, because, you know, if you've ever been on a highway, it's like, what's the difference between a bunch of cars that are spewing gasoline and exhaust versus, you know, a bunch of cars with batteries? It doesn't really solve our transit problems. And then people are becoming pretty aware of the environmental problems of batteries and the kind of the global problems of batteries and where they're going to get those minerals from and what kind of wars and imperialist adventures that's going to lead to, coups, those sorts of things. And then will Unifor take some kind of independent political path as opposed to kind of just lobbying establishment politicians? Maybe it's time that, they go back to their original split from the NDP in the 1990s and explore the possibility of a new party or some kind of new candidates that could challenge the establishment parties, which I would lump the NDP in with now. Yeah, I will stop there. I've talked too much.
Doug, I just want to go back to the original part, because maybe for a lot of people who, especially maybe in the Montreal context, who maybe didn't follow what was, because it's covered mostly also in the, Toronto Star or the Globe and Mail, but because this idea of dictatorship and, he handpicked Scott Doherty, but there was also someone else that believed that they should have been the chosen successor, that kind of the level of patronage, because there was another, that Jerry sort of played one person, part of this he had this dilemma of who was going to be the successor to him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I can't really say for sure who those people might have been. I kind of have ideas, so I don't want to really throw out names, but you're absolutely right. It was kind of like a Game of Thrones. People were jockeying for position leading up, through the years, trying to curry favor with Diaz so Diaz would create a position for them to move into. That is totally how Unifor has been running as a patronage operation. And also there is a tradition that Unifor has inherited that is a very old, undemocratic tradition. And there's this thing called the Administrative Caucus, and it's essentially a one-party state where the president is the general secretary of the party. And it's called the Administrative Caucus, and it was inherited from the CAW. That's how the CAW ran. And that was inherited from the UAW, which is how the UAW ran. And it has its origins in the late 40s when the UAW suppressed the internal democracy in the auto workers union with the rise of Walter Reuther. He purged the left. He purged anyone who had who was a small C or big C communist, and he suppressed the power of rank and file workers on the shop floor. And they created this one party kind of thing called the Administrative Caucus that the CAW inherited. And you had people like Bob White who would, at least to a degree, in like have an enlarged view of what the Administrative Caucus would be. So he'd bring dissidents inside in order to get a range of views, and then he would dictate what he would do based on that. But over time, through the 90s and 2000s, the Administrative Caucus became narrower and narrower until it was just a bunch of people who were on this pipeline upward and try to curry favor, patronage positions. And when CAW merged with CEP, this big merger that created Unifor in 2013, and Jerry Diaz becomes the president, the CAW Administrative Caucus just moves right in, and Diaz comes from the Administrative Caucus in the CAW. So they just took over completely, and they brought in people like Doherty, who was from the CEP. The CEP was a much more decentralized kind of union. There's a telecommunications worker friend of mine who is a Unifor member, and he used to be in CEP. And the way he always put it was that the CEP had way more local democracy, but if you needed to unite the union to do something, they could never get it done. It was so decentralized. So as a result, when it merged with CAW, the Administrative Caucus was the only organized leadership body, and it just took over the union, and that's what Diaz was on top of. So that's the kind of system that we've just seen kind of hit the wall in terms of corruption at the start of this year. Now, whether or not it can be dismantled, that's something else. I don't think anybody's actually talking about that at the top of Unifor.
One of the things that me and Mustafa were talking about before we started recording today was all of the, so rank and file, you went through the executive minutes. That sort of brings to mind though, maybe you can explain the difference between the National Executive Board and the administrative, whatever it's called you were just talking about. But also, there's still redactions, lots of redactions, even though there was a less redacted version that they sent out later. I want to know what you think about the idea that this is the tip of the iceberg, because when we were talking, me and Mustafa, and I won't take credit for your insight, Moose, but $50,000 of kickbacks is not very much for an organization the size of Unifor, and it's not necessarily something that's going to take down leadership. They have ways to kind of quiet these types of things when they happen. So $50,000 is really peanuts, especially when you look at their salaries and sort of what they have in the bank and what kind of properties they live in. So there's this notion that maybe this is not really what the problem was. This is a way to sort of mask something else. Because, for example, other big private sector unions, I mean, the steelworkers just had their convention basically at the same time as Unifor. They got a big scandal here in Quebec right now with a union official running off with a ton of money from the local. But that's the locals' money. Diaz, according to this, didn't take any money from members. That's a lot less bad, and that's going to make people a lot less mad than if he's walking away with their money. So I want to hear what you have to say about the notion that there's something else much bigger than this behind, and if you think it's going to come to light, or if you think like they're just closing ranks and they're going to steer this ship exactly the same course that it's already been on.
Yeah, I definitely think that the $50,000 is the tip of the iceberg. And you're right, it wasn't the union membership's money. It was given to them by this supplier of PPE. And this is part of the issue with the investigation report that was released. Was initially they released a report that, I think, what was it, 16 or out of 25 pages, something like that, were completely missing. Then I was able to get access to the full report, or at least every page, but there are still large redactions when it comes to who these individuals were, the corporate individuals tied to the PPE supplier. The PPE supplier is blacked out, and then the employers that receive the PPE are blacked out as well. So we have no idea who these companies are and who these individuals are. And I tried with a few people to figure out, like, could we reasonably suggest who it might be? And it's too difficult. At first I thought, well, maybe it has something to do with the airlines, because around the time that this was happening, the airlines were pushing for the federal government to accept these special antigen rapid tests, which is what this equipment was that was sold, that Diaz had brokered a deal with. But I couldn't find no connection. But then there are other questions, like there was a Globe and Mail report, a story that came out in March when the whole scandal was exploding, and they looked into Diaz's properties. And I found this blew my mind. I'm sure it would anybody else who has like any knowledge of how one goes about buying a house, even if you don't have one, is that if you don't have a mortgage when you buy a house, it means you've either bought the house outright or you have a private loan. And Diaz in September of 2021, and this is like 3 months before he brokers this deal, he gets a like $1.3 million condo on the Toronto waterfront, and there's no mortgage attached to it. So it was either paid outright or it was a private loan. Even if it was a private loan, it's like, who's loaning you the $1.3 million, right? And in addition to that, he has a $1 million property in another part of Toronto, and then he has a Florida condo. It's like, where does all this money come from? Is he really making that much money as the union president? How do you buy a condo on the Toronto waterfront in cash? I think there's a lot more going on. The other thing to think about is the kickbacks that you can get don't have to be necessarily cash. I mean, there's wheeling and dealing that are going on with these companies, right? So one of the issues might be, and this might be one of the reasons the names of the employers who bought the test kits are blacked out, is like they don't want to tell their members who they were doing deals with, because maybe there was another deal that wasn't financial that had something to do with the contract. So, you know, you agree to buy these things and we will make these concessions in the next round of bargaining. That is the type of thing that could have happened. And knowing Diaz's record for concession bargaining and accepting things like two-tier contracts and just refusing to fight them. You know, the mind can race trying to like figure out what he is actually up to. But I think you're right that to a degree that the information was released in order to give the impression that they were dealing with some, you know, they were cleaning up the corruption internally. But what it's really doing is it's the smoke. It's not actually the fire.
Yeah, because I mean, one of the things that, you know, like that was unique at convention, there was no dragging him down, right? There was no, I mean, in fact, you know, it was just like Diaz was like the ghost in the room, but no one was going to, you know, even speak his name or speak to the issue. So there was a lot of, from all the candidates and interventions, it was just a lot of, how to call it, there was, you know, and this was the thing that made you feel that, is there something else going on, was that it wasn't about, you know, there was calls for greater transparency, but no one was saying, well, who are our leaders meeting with and what are they getting from them? And, you know, and that leads to, you know, concessions and the two-tier bargaining and all of that and the kickbacks, but a lot of it was on greater transparency on financial reporting within the union and the role of certain staff, which got mentioned by, I mean, particularly Cassidy, kept on leveraging that, you know, that sort of in a kind of this populist, internal populist way, right? That our dues, our members are being used nefariously by staff to engineer this election or to do other things. So it felt like that there was, you felt that there was hints to something else going on.
Yeah, for sure. And the staff is one of those bridges between what else is going on and that whole problem of the administrative caucus, that this leadership body isn't just elected officials, it's staff as well. And those staff jobs are patronage appointments. So, you know, if you do all the right things and you kind of kiss ass enough, then you are going to get into that position. And those staff people wield a lot of power. I mean, that's not unique to Unifor, but it is real in Unifor, and it's a problem. There are no kind of easy solutions to that, but definitely the staff have an immense amount of power, and we're definitely involved in the ins and outs of the scandal that happened. A lot of the leaks that went to the press around it were, the press reported that they were coming from staff or elected officials, which kind of makes you like, imagine staff in a union like leaking union documents to the press and then not being reprimanded. Like no staff have been identified. I mean, it's kind of wild that stuff would be happening. Not that, you know, certain kinds of whistleblowers aren't important, but, you know, there's also people who are leaking materials to kind of set a different kind of narrative that has an ulterior motive. And I think that you can definitely see that happening as well in how the scandal unfolded. And it's kind of remarkable to hear that Jerry was the ghost in the room. It's like, well, this... And now that we've had another one of these things happen, and it sounds like we're just going to bury it, we're not going to talk about it. And I mean, how is that good for union democracy? I don't know.
Well, I mean, it feels like when you mentioned it, which was that this wasn't, you know, despite the election feeling like, you know, that, and it was true that there was, you know, finally this moment of democracy, and there was sort of that excitement. But there was also this talk, you know, and forget her name, and the Ontario director, who actually ran on Scott Doherty's slate. I mean, she was the only one from Scott Doherty's slate who won. Again, I forget her.
Ritzvi, yeah.
Yeah. You know, and she framed it as like, we're one, you know, we're one big family, and sometimes we got our fights, and sometimes you know, people are going to not like each other, but we're going to get through this and we're going to come out better. And it was, so if it, it felt like this, it wasn't truly a bottom up revolt, but it, it felt like the national leadership was just kind of cleaning house.
Mm.
No, the reason, I mean, I was kind of bringing this was that how much, you know, and you mentioned it too, Doug, was that what do you feel that Lena Payne sort of represents? Was it just sort of like, you know, is it like in that moment where you're stuck voting Joe Biden versus Donald Trump, or is Lena Payne like a break or an alternative? Like, how did you view her run at national president?
Yeah, it's a tough one to crack. I feel like we'll have a better idea in the future. But she definitely comes from inside the Unifor establishment, and she had a long history in Newfoundland coming out of the FFAW, the fisheries union, the pretty powerful and important union in Newfoundland's history that was formed in the early 70s, really militant history. But I've searched and I haven't really figured out what her background is in the FFAW, other than I have been reading a book about their history, and which I plan to review in the near future. I was kind of waiting till this election was over to review it. And there is a reference to her being a staff person sometime in the 90s. So maybe I'm wrong about that and I got the wrong information, but I kind of wonder when is the last time, like, where does Payne come from? Does she come from a workplace, or does she come from a staff background? And she's certainly been a union official, like a union brass for quite a long time. So, and is very, very rare. I can't even think of an example of a union being reformed from within and from the top in that way. So I don't really have, I'm really not holding out a lot of hope, but maybe there are certain like large scale shifts that could happen that would at least open up some space. Not that they are the things that you would want to necessarily lead on. I do think that it would be useful for her to lead, and she's already shown indications of this, of leading Unifor back into the Canadian Labour Congress, because it's had a really negative effect on a lot of local organizing, especially when you have local leaderships who are highly dependent on following a higher up leadership. So you really need like a strong local in Unifor and then strong locals who aren't Unifor to be able to maintain those bridges, while Jerry Diaz and, you know, all those people at the top of the unions were squabbling and then split. So that might be useful. In terms of political strategy, I mean, again, I don't think kind of running back into the arms of the NDP is really going to do anything. So I don't think there's much that can be done on there. I mean, and then in terms of strategy against employers, there's been a pretty obvious strategy that the auto workers, who still are a powerful kind of core of Unifor, and this ties into other sectors, is challenging capital through international supply chains. I mean, capitalism right now is in this seem intractable crisis because the pandemic has disrupted supply chains so much, because they made them so lean that they became so brittle that the moment that they face some kind of shock, they're completely useless. And that was the method that the auto workers should have been using over the last 30 years to squeeze capital. Instead, the auto workers went the other direction, which was to take an increasingly nationalist direction, where It's like, oh, stop taking our jobs to Mexico, stop taking our jobs to Korea, instead of trying to build and coordinate with Korean or Mexican and American and you know, German and other auto workers, Italian auto workers around the world, and try to come up with some kind of strategy where you could actually get workers in other countries participating in some kind of labor struggle around auto. I mean, that's a tall order, but it has to start somewhere, and they haven't done it. They haven't done it at all. And the pandemic and the supply chain crisis that is happening right now just shows that it was possible, because the whole setup is so brittle. Heck, the Freedom Convoy idiots in Windsor showed what could be done by just blockading the bridge. I mean, maybe the union should take a page out of that strategy. I mean, Indigenous people have been doing that for a while with bridges. I mean, why aren't we? I don't know. There's no learning going on, and it's kind of, I question whether or not the new leadership will actually learn anything, or just kind of change the window dressing, kind of have a more progressive sheen on it, and yeah, kind of rebrand basically.
Do you think this gives like a bit of, I don't know if through your work or because I didn't hear any rumblings really of it inside the convention, but it's sort of the what took place with the UAW, right? The one member, one vote.
Yeah, that's so strange, isn't it? There were a few good resolutions that I saw. I don't know what happened with them in the convention. I believe it was, that's not true. I think it was Unifor Local 88, which is the CAMI assembly plant in Ingersoll. They're a curious local. They have a very like independent and militant history. And it's still kind of independent thinking, independent minded these days still. And they put forward a motion that I think would have tackled to some degree the staff problem. And that wasn't addressed, but I don't remember there being any resolution for one member, one vote. I think that would be a good thing to do for the union, because it would circumvent the power of the patronage system to a degree. It would undermine it to a degree, because the conventions right now, as I think I mentioned earlier, the delegations are elected at the local level, and a lot of those quote unquote elections for delegates aren't really elections. They're all stitch ups basically by this patronage system that reaches right down into the local. You only have to talk to people in some of the old locals, like Local 222 in Oshawa, and they will, you know, dissonance will tell you all the different techniques that people are basically prevented from becoming delegates to different meetings, getting elected to different positions, those sorts of things. So there's a lot to be done in terms of actually reforming it. And I really did not see a lot of talk about what's happening in UAW. I think that that's one of the consequences of the kind of blind Canadian nationalism that is allowed to exist in Unifor and is promoted by the leadership when they see fit. It's like they should be working with UAW. They should be trying to figure out where they can actually build a relationship again. The split was in the 1980s. it's a long time ago. It's time to get over.
What was your feeling, Mustafa, from being there? What was your general feeling about them? Because I feel like the article on Rank and File talks about the problems to do with this particular $50,000 problem or whatever. But I guess the question that is asked at the end of the article is, you know, where do you go from here? Because this is, you know, like you said, it's the smoke, it's not the fire. There's so many things that can be so much better. I mean, in terms of like the coverage, and I did a very cursory look at this, is basically headlines about Payne getting elected and then press releases from Unifor about how they're a union for everyone or together or whatever the slogan is from this convention. So I guess my sense is that there was a lot more at the convention itself, and that maybe you could tell us a bit about what was the feeling that you were sort of privy to on the floor of the convention.
Well, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, there was like one, there was just the, I mean, the first thing was just even the, I think people almost even forgot why that they were having a contested election, but it was just simply the fact that there was a contested election, I think, which is an interesting combination of terms, because if there's no one running, then it's really hard to call it an election. They only call it contested if there's more than one candidate. So this is Unifor's first contested. And I think even within the CAW prior, I think you have to go back, and maybe Doug can maybe Doug knows more, but you have to go back, I think, for a long time for there to see a contested election. I mean, the floor itself was kind of just, everyone, because the election was happening midway. So the whole focus, everyone's energy was simply campaigning, you know, between the three different slates, Dave Cassidy's and Lena Payne's and Scott Doherty's. And so there was a lot of that. And there was a lot of, you know, it felt like, you know, everyone had t-shirts, everyone was being flyered and postered, and like, you know, and a lot of it seemed was around this. So, I mean, to me, and there was a kind of an excitement. There was sort of like this, we have to do this. But, you know, and for some delegates, I think there was also, they saw it as an opportunity. I mean, my perspective from the Quebec delegation also was that Quebec voted on a single block for Lena Payne as the region. So that was also sort of this, like that the entire region just voted and pretty much in one succinct block. And so that was a clear, I think, push for Lena. And I mean, Daniel Cloutier, I mean, you know, they felt that there was this need for like, there's no way Unifor could go forward. I mean, they just couldn't, to have Scott win. And I guess there was enough loyalty to Scott as well in terms of the percentage of Lena winning, because there was a runoff between Lena and Scott, right? And because David Cassidy was like the long shot. But the fact that there was still significant delegate support for Scott was interesting, and he seemed like the louder candidate in the actual convention, but I think didn't actually expect to lose. Scott was not, you know, if you thought throughout like the visual size and, you know, the amount of delegates wearing Scott Doherty t-shirts and that you thought they were going to win, and the fact that, I mean, you did, it was a big upset, and I think sort of quieted the mood for a lot of people at convention. I mean, so, I mean, it really, the election dominated, but I mean, I think some people also saw it finally as like, even if it was in house, even if it was, you know, Lena Payne represents the establishment, I think a lot of people saw it finally as like, we broke the glass, you know what I mean? Like we can finally, this could change the culture, at least politically inside Unifor, that there could be future elections, you know, contested elections at the leadership level. So I think having that space, I mean, the The other thing in terms of what was also interesting in terms of convention was, which I guess, I mean, which is a bad barometer of the mood, was the labor minister spoke. And I think a lot of people noted that for the first time that a liberal cabinet minister comes to a Unifor convention, wasn't given a full standing ovation, that like half the delegates, you know, didn't stand for him. And Lana was pressed to actually ask him questions on inflation and, you know, to kind of put him in the corner a little bit. So it wasn't a lovey-dovey sort of thing. But also Jagmeet was there as well, which was also, and then the invited guests. I mean, it was fascinating. I mean, there was other parts to the convention too, which, I mean, most of it is always congratulatory, I think, the Unifor conventions, but particularly, you know, they have their push now, whether it's real or not, also around Amazon. They invited Derek Palmer, the, you know, vice president of the Amazon Labor Union, to speak, you know, as well as myself. So they have this push, you know, to, you know, the fact that Jagmeet and Sean Omegas were there was the, I think, sort of like this key part. And also, I think them feeling congratulated. I mean, I think one thing that came out in all the camps, especially Doherty, was that people's bargaining experience. Like Doug mentioned it before, but this idea that we're the union that gets it done at the bargaining table, you know, that like that could have been the slogan, right? But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't that. But I mean, Lana's rhetoric was different too, I think, which was slightly refreshing, you know, talking about class. She used the word class in her nomination speech and in her victory speech. So I think that was probably interesting too. So I mean, the convention definitely had its ups and downs, but it was clearly just dominated by this election.
Yeah, the one of the things to mention is, yeah, you're right, that there are very, very, very few contested elections in Unifor or CAW preceding that. The founding Unifor convention did have a challenger, which a lot of people forgot, which was a rank and file auto worker from Oakville, Lindsay Hinchelwood. I interviewed her at the time. She was awesome. She was really keen to she just told it like it was, and she talked about an old boys club that ran the union, that they were giving in all sorts of concessions to capital, that they were corrupt. I mean, she went on and on and on in this interview I did with her. And there was also a candidate who challenged, I think it was Buzz Hargrove in 2006 when it was CAW. And his name was Willie Lambert, and he was also from Oakville, but he was a bus driver, and he was just, you know, he was a union activist, and he was also saying that the union had capitulated to concession bargaining, and that it had no strategy for how to deal with these things. And he was talking about like international unionism, as opposed to wrapping themselves in the flag like the union had done for so long. And though, like Willie Lambert, there's a whole story there about him being iced out of the union after that. And he was a persona non grata. And I don't know if Lindsay Hinchelwood still works at Ford Oakville. I'd have to reach out to her and see. But those rank and file campaigns, the kind of tragedy of Lambert's campaign was that he withdrew shortly before the convention. So he never actually contested the election. And the weakness of Lindsay's campaign was that it was the last minute, like spur of the moment challenge. So there was no effort to build up. But it's worth noting that she and Cassidy got basically the same percentage of delegate votes, which was something like 17 or 18%. So, I mean, there's a good number of people who are, even at the delegated convention, who are looking for a different direction. I mean, if you want to take that as a guide across the union, like, you know, 15 to 20% of the union, then that's not a bad place to start with if you're going to focus on in between conventions. The focus on bargaining is definitely an area where pressure could be applied to the union leadership. The fight around getting rid of two-tier contracts, I think, is a no-brainer. I mean, any kind of union activist who is in a two-tier contract workplace, I mean, that's number one. Like, you just have to go after that. It's the only way to get rid of that kind of poison within a workplace. But yeah, the absence of a democratic culture is definitely on display, because people just don't know what to do or even to say when these openings happen, and kind of people are at a loss and nobody's prepared to seize on them. It's like Unifor has some networks of dissidents. There's the Unifor Solidarity Network, which I know you can, you know, plug into through something like Facebook, but it predates the pandemic, but it's not an organization that has meetings or any kind of conventions of its own. So the task of actually building union democracy is like, it's we're at a really, really low point, and abysmal, the absence of any kind of coordination between dissidents and unions and democratic reformers. People are kind of just permanently flat-footed, and at least with Diaz out of the way, it seems like there's probably going to be a period of time with where things will be just a little more open, and maybe that will just create enough space for something better to generate. But that also means cutting against the waiting around for the leaders, you know, the habit of waiting around for leaders to do stuff on behalf of the union, which I don't think is a very well proven means of change. It just doesn't happen that way in unions. There has to be a challenge somewhere, and that means there's going to have to be a conflict, like a clash between different visions of the union, and it has to come to a head at some point. The task of the dissidents is to actually organize for that clash, whether it's demanding a repeal of two-tier and rejecting shitty agreements that are sent down to the membership and mobilizing the membership to defeat them, or it's making sure that bargaining committees and bargaining teams and mobilization teams are actually full of the people who are committed to a particular direction or are working together in that direction to get rid of two-tier and to defeat concessions. But that democracy is going to have to start at the local level and work its way up through Unifor. I don't think there's going to be like a democratic transformation from the top, but maybe an opening of space, space to learn how to do democracy.
It's tough. Like, Unifor is a gigantic union, and I think that just bears some repeating, because I was looking at their numbers today, and I think it's something over 300,000 workers, and almost 350.
Yeah,
and like 800 locals or something like this. So again, like, the what's particularly hard, I would say, is like, and not to mention like just a bit of breadth of territory, a lot of, like, democracy is harder when you're bigger, you know, and it's it's not an argument against trying, but definitely if there's no like organized factions working on it, that's the first thing that they have to do, because like fixing one local isolated by itself is going to do less than nothing, basically. It'll help the people there, it won't help anybody else. So
yeah, I mean, one area that has been kind of interesting with Unifor lately, and I'm not by no means an expert on this, is what's happening in some of the warehouses with the agreements and some of the small strikes that have been happening, like in the whole St. Lawrence Valley into Southern Ontario. So there's been action around the inflation question on wages, and there have been some pretty impressive settlements relative to what's happened in the last few years. And maybe there's room for some kind of network to develop in warehouses, but that's I'm hoping that's going to happen, because I don't know where that is happening other than in non-union warehouses where networks are developing for union drives.
Prior to Unifor, right? I mean, I remember the time of CAW flying squads.
Yeah.
And that was an impressive, you know, for me. But I mean, I guess there's a reason why that history, no one's talking about them at, you know, convention and reviving that, you know, but it's going to have to take, I guess, you know, from below dissidents. I mean, outside of warehouse, the only sector I can think of where, you know, you have pockets of this, you know, radical is in some of the locals in the airlines.
Yeah, I mean, it's a union. Like, CAW just has this incredible history that could be drawn upon. I mean, it's the union, like you said, it's the union of flying squads. It's the union of plant occupations. It's the union of sympathy strikes. It's the unions of sit-ins. You know, it's got that history, and it could, and it's not, a lot of it isn't that old. I mean, that CAMI local I was saying, Local 88 in Ingersoll, that was only unionized in 1989. A friend of mine who used to work there, he worked there for the first decade. He was one of the first hires in 88 when it was a Suzuki General Motors joint venture, and they're trying to create this plant based on, like, we're going to import all the most modern Japanese methods. And what they quickly found out what those methods are is just constant speed up. And all this idea about worker control was just immediately went out the window. And he would boast, he's like, I went on 3 strikes at CAMI and only one of them was legal. And I'm like, that's the kind of history of even the CAW in the 90s. A lot of those people aren't around anymore and have retired. And I mean, just the work that those auto workers do, like, they don't live long lives either. I mean, a lot of them are going to be, they're dead in their late 50s or 60s. I mean, they're lucky if they reach retirement because it's such a brutal job. But those traditions, they're still around and they could be tapped. And the stuff that we saw, at least recently, like in Scarborough with the HBC warehouse strike, that was pretty impressive. And that had those elements. I mean, multicultural, multiracial, multilingual workforce, people all around the world working there. And they actually defeated this huge corporation. And it was pretty impressive. And so, yeah, you got to look at those things as the way forward for Unifor and the members.
Well, maybe on that note, we should leave it. thanks again for coming back on Labor Radio, Doug. It's always a pleasure. I sometimes feel like we're just having nerd talk, but I'm sure there's some people listening who are interested. God bless you if you are.
Thanks. I love hearing you guys and listening to you guys. It's been nice learning about the show, and now I listen to it. So thank you.
Oh, well, cheers. We'll have you back a third time, I'm sure.
Awesome.
So everybody, go check out Doug's website, rankandfile.ca. It's definitely an essential place to learn about workers' struggles in Canada.
And welcome back to Labor Radio here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We were just listening to a long discussion with the editor of rankandfile.ca, Doug Nesbitt. We talked about, you know, the context of the recent Unifor convention and the retirement of the president, Jerry Diaz, and the corruption scandal and the sort of the
Since COVID-19 was more than 5 months ago, it's time to get another dose. Boosting your antibodies reduces the risk of getting or transmitting the virus, and booster doses help reduce the number of hospitalizations and deaths related to COVID-19. For better protection against the virus, book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine and follow the recommended vaccination schedule. Vaccination against COVID-19, a good way of extending our protection. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Evening. It's 6 p.m. on the clock. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 on your FM dial and at CKUT.ca, which can be found on the World Wide Web, also known as the Information Superhighway, but more commonly known as the Internet. It's the show about theater on the radio. And if you're asking yourself, hey, that's not Sarah DeHay, you'd be correct. My name is James, and I'll be filling in for Sarah, who will be back next week. But in the meantime and in between time, I'm very glad to be here this evening. I've been a guest on this show a variety of times, and I'm excited to be sitting in the captain's chair, and I will do everything in my power to not burn the place to the ground, which is extremely important because I'm recording this from my home. What we are going to be talking about over the next hour, well, as an avid practitioner in the art of improvised comedy, it only felt right to discuss Montreal Improv's Summer Fling Festival, which begins tonight up until Sunday at the Montreal Improv Theater in St. Henry. 9 shows, 50 performers, 4 days of fun, 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 till your daddy takes your T-Bird away. Tonight's guests include festival performers Dale Bernier, Avery Jean, Dave Kaufman, and so much more. But if you're asking yourself, James, why wait? Why are you teasing us? I couldn't agree more. Let's kick things off and chat with Montreal Improv Artistic Director and Festival Organizer Vance Gillis and producer of Parce que Why Not, a bilingual improv show, Mel McRae on Upstage.